When the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain. And you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
Hi, I'm Mark Laren Young, and welcome back to the Green Chain Podcast, part two of our special feature interview with Forest Ethics founder, Sephora Berman. How does a former protester deal with people in suits? And what happens to your EnviroCred when you start making deals with the people in suits? Time to suit up and find out.
How did you switch from Greenpeace to Forest Ethics?
Well, when we went to the U.S. initially, during Clackwit, to get support from U.S. groups. We did it intentionally because the U.S. is the largest market for Canadian forest products. And so we convinced Rainforest Action Network and Greenpeace and NRDC to create this little coalition of groups that were going to work on BC forest issues, and we called it the Coastal Rainforest Coalition. And I was on the board of directors and was a founding member of the Coastal Rainforest Coalition. And in about, was it in the year 2000, we were sitting around realizing that the groups who originally founded it had kind of moved on and were not as engaged in BC forest issues anymore. But now the Coastal Rainforest Coalition was in itself an organization that was functioning and still working. And so we said, well, let's just do that. Let's just make it a standalone organization whose mandate is to use the financial and political influence from the marketplace to protect endangered forests. And so we did. And it was actually Forest Ethics, most people don't know this, was named in the Elijo Valley here in British Columbia. We did a strategy retreat to talk about what we were going to do and how we were going to run our campaigns. And we had been debating the name for a long time. We can't change Coastal Rainforest Coalition. We've already had it for 4 years. And other people were saying, no, we need something entirely different. You know, we need the Something Action Network and, you know, all these names. And then we went on a hike in the Elijo Valley. And someone said, we just have to call it Forest. And someone else said, well, what if we just combined it with ethics? Because that's what we want. If we want people to have ethics about how we interact with nature. And then we all went, yeah, okay, Forest Ethics. And that was it. It was so anticlimactic. After like months, we had been doing focus groups and we'd hired Fenton Media Communications and, you know, trying to figure out how we're going to do this thing. And it just came out in the Elijo Valley. And we created Forest Ethics. And it was like 2 weeks later that a bunch of Chilean organizations approached us and said, we want to learn about what you're doing in the Great Bear Rainforest because we have temperate rainforests, and can you do it for us too? And so that's how we ended up having Forest Ethics Chile, is that we replicated what we'd done in the Great Bear Rainforest and in Clackwit. We tracked Chilean products. We went to a bunch of companies who were buying radiata pine from Chile. We found an alternative, which is Forest Stewardship Council certified second growth radiata pine from New Zealand. Showed them that they could buy the alternative, make a political statement by not buying native forest destruction from Chile, and went to Home Depot, who we now had a relationship with from many years of negotiating with them, and got them to broker a discussion between Aruco and Mininco, who are responsible for 80% of all the logging in Chile, between Home Depot, who is their largest customer, and all the conservation organizations in Chile. And we protected 1 million acres of native forest in Chile. And there's still a joint solutions project of the environmental groups and the logging companies working together to map and protect native forests in Chile today as a result of it. So it was literally like we took the model of what we did in the Great Bear and planted it into Chile.
Now, one of the things I find fascinating is Forest Ethics works with the companies. Did you have any resistance to that? Did you have any people saying, no, you can't work with the companies, all logging is bad?
Oh, for sure. And it's not easy. Because when you look at what's left globally, you know, the 80% of the world's intact forests are already gone. You know, on a purely ecological basis, I don't think we should be logging old growth at all. You know, even if we stopped logging today, old growth today, we can't be sure that the ecosystem remnants that we have left will survive in any form of where they are today. Because they've already been so heavily devastated. And so there's still today a lot of people who criticize us, you know, because, not a lot, actually, couple of key armchair activists who criticize us because they think we should be taking harder stances and saying absolutely no logging. But in my mind, if we just create little parks and we're not working to change the way the economy works and to help create sustainable jobs and a conservation-based economy, then those parks will just be reopened to logging in 10 years. And so what we decided to do in the Great Bear was protect all of the intact valleys. You know, when we started the campaign, there were 359 valleys originally on the coast. There were 69 left. All 69 were slated to be logged, roaded or logged in the next 5 years. So we said, all 69. We want all 69. We want all of the intact valleys. But that still leaves, you know, acres and tens of millions of acres of forest that's very fragmented and already has roads in it, but it's old growth.
Yeah.
And we said, you know, well, let's, you know, leave the pristine areas alone and use that as your test case to see whether you can do good management, ecosystem-based management, and actually derive some economic benefit while maintaining enough of the forest to, you know, the structure and composition of the forest to have a healthy ecosystem, to replace, to not do clear cutting, but to do something different. And there were people who criticized us, and that is difficult, sitting with those companies when you really... But what do you have to negotiate if you're sitting across a table with someone and saying, actually, what I really want you to do is go out of business, and I want all logging to stop, and do you think you could do that? Like, there's nowhere to go with that, right? There's no... And so, you know, we started trying to figure out... you know, already we were pushing them so far. No one had ever negotiated for more than a valley at once in this province. And we came in and said, we want the west coast of the country, everything that's left intact. At the time, we actually got criticized by other environmental groups because we were asking for too much. We were, you know, I had some people who remain unnamed at this point actually come in and say, you're making the environmental movement look hysterical and crazy. You can't ask for that. And now, 10 years later, you know, they're actually, when we signed the Great Bear Agreement to protect, you know, 5 million acres of rainforest, every single one of those damn valleys, we got criticized for supporting any logging at all in old growth. So, you know, I don't know. Where you draw the line, I think, is one of the most difficult parts of this work.
Now, do you work with Forest Stewardship Council? Is there a particular group that you feel good about the way they certify wood? Or
yeah, I mean,
are you becoming
good,
sort of your own certification?
I mean, to be gut honest, group? I don't, you know, when I walk through an FSC certified logging operation, I think it's a hell of a lot better. That's true. I don't generally feel good about logging at all, but I think it's really good. I think it's a lot better. So forest ethics and, you know, supports Forest Stewardship Council certified logging operations. And we've worked really hard to make sure that they have strong guidelines, as strong as has been possible. And I think it's a huge leap up from about 90% of the logging we have today. And so what we do is we push from the outside to make sure that the FSC has the strongest guidelines possible, and then we work with corporations and push some corporations to demand FSC products to increase the demand.
Okay. Tell me, us, I'm still not used to the concept of the, you know, third person interview, about the Victoria's Secret campaign, because that was an incredible campaign, and that seems like one of the best environmental success stories I've ever heard.
Yeah, the Victoria's Secret campaign was just so fun because it's so strange to think about a lingerie company and forests. You know, there was just such a mental disconnect that it caught everyone's attention. And so what happened is we decided to launch the Boreal campaign, and we started doing chain of custody research to look at why is, you know, who's buying the most boreal forest? What's it being logged for? And we overlaid that with what are the most important areas to protect. So in the west coast of the boreal, some of the most important areas are in the Rocky Mountain foothills, because it's the bridge between the mountain ecosystems and the boreal ecosystems, and that little valley is incredibly lush. And you've already got some big protected areas, Jasper and Banff, but they're not connected in any way. So your caribou and other species are endangered there because there's no corridors to connect them. They can't roam. And so we decided to focus initially on that area, and our research was showing that the Hinton Mill was producing an enormous amount of pulp and paper for catalogs. And so we did some research. We found out that the top six catalog companies in North America were all buying from the boreal, and that they had less than 10% recycled content in their catalogs, every single one of them. And then we found out that Victoria's Secret was producing 1 million catalogs a day. And the majority of it was coming from Canada's old-growth forests, being pulped to make Victoria's Secret catalogs that, you know, most people never read. Victoria's Secret was sending out, you know, like 1 million catalogs a day. It's just absolutely absurd. So we went to them, and we said, you know, our research is showing this. We think you can be using a paper with a higher recycled content. You can be using FSC-certified fiber. We'd like to work with you to help green your catalog. And they initially said, oh, you know, we'll think about it. We'll talk to you about it. International Paper organized a tour of the region in Alberta for all the catalog companies. And the catalog companies refused to go unless we were also present. So I went on a tour of Alberta with all of these catalog companies and International Paper and West Fraser. And it was just absurd. I got to see what they really do. They took them to protected areas, and then they took them to selective logging operations and said, this is the way of the future, and doesn't this look like a beautiful logging operation? And so I said, so how much of the logging you're doing today is selective logging and how much is clear-cut logging? And eventually, after hammering on them, it came out that 97% of the logging they were doing was clear-cut logging, but they only showed the catalog companies this one example of a selective logging operation. The entire time they were in Alberta, they never went to clear-cut. It was fascinating. Anyways, even at the end of that tour, Victoria's Secret renewed a two-year contract, primarily because it was cheap and it was easy. And they thought we were too small to have an impact on them. So we took out a full-page ad in the New York Times that had a woman wearing lingerie carrying a chainsaw, and it said, Victoria's got a dirty secret. And that one ad, for whatever it was like half of our budget. It was like $25,000, which was a fortune to us. But it was such a controversial ad that we earned so much additional media. We estimate that it, you know, the equivalent of a $2 million media buy, because all these newspapers and television stations were like holding up the ad when they and interviewing us. And, you know, it was so controversial because it was a brand attack.
Well, it was right up there with Joe Chemo for me. That was just a perfect Adbusters ad.
Yeah, I had a panic initially that it was that as a feminist I couldn't have I couldn't pay for an ad that had a woman in lingerie, you know, holding a chainsaw and the New York Times. But so I emailed it to Gloria Steinem and Judy Arebic, and they both came back saying, "I love that ad." And I thought, "All right, I'm fine." But so we did the ad, and then we started doing grassroots organizing across the United States. And over a two-year period, we did 750 protests in front of Victoria's Secret stores. And within 6 months of the campaign starting, they came to us and said, okay, we want to talk. But they had a two-year contract, and they were legally bound into that contract. So they had a lot of trouble moving. And also the paper that we wanted them to use really didn't exist in the world, because no one was making catalog paper with any recycled content, any significant recycled content. And no supplier would commit to not buying from endangered species habitat or old-growth forests. And so in the process of working with Victoria's Secret, we changed the way that catalog paper is made in North America. And we're still working with them today. I wouldn't say their catalog's green now. I would say that they've committed to green principles. They have the best procurement policy of any company, almost of any catalog company in the world. And more than that, they've committed to work with us to help protect forests. So what that's meant is that, you know, I have the senior vice president of the Limited Brands, which is Victoria's Secret's parent company, flying to Ontario and Alberta and British Columbia with me to lobby the government to protect more forests and do better logging, or else they won't buy from them again. And it's a whole different thing to be in a lobby meeting when you're sitting next to a guy in an Armani suit who buys $100 million worth of paper every year.
Yeah, it was trying
then to... all of a sudden you have the attention of the ministers, you know, so it's... it's been an incredible experience, and I think that, you know, and it's really clear to me now working with the rest of the catalog industry that they're the first of many companies. And one just last month, Forest Ethics launched its second campaign, and we're targeting Sears, and we're just building that campaign.
Nice. Now, one thing that you said at the 11th hour premiere here that really stuck with me was that the rest of the world had finally caught up to where BC was at. And how strange that must be for British Columbians.
Yeah.
And certainly for me, when I look out and see the changes in terms of people talking about issues that I've been talking about or aware of and all my friends have been talking about since, you know, I was in university.
Yeah.
And now to hear, you know, now you can go to Toronto and people actually talk about trees, forests, whales. I mean, I'm really aware of this because I toured Canada with a comedy group doing environmental comedy. We stopped doing environmental comedy as soon as we crossed the Alberta border. Because what would happen would be we'd sing about dolphins and people would stare at us and we'd go, okay, fine, make the Tonya Harding joke, I'm there. You know, and we did the environmental stuff in Toronto. They just sort of stared at us blankly and politely.
Yeah.
You know, now I'm going.
Now green's the new black.
Exactly. how do you think that's happened? Why?
I think there's no question that it's a combination of things that creates a tipping point. But I believe that it's primarily because people can see the impacts of industrial development, the cumulative impacts of industrial development in all of its forms on natural ecosystems in our everyday lives. I mean, everyone, you know, sat and watched with horror as the world's greatest superpower struggled to deal with the aftermath of Katrina. 1 million environmental refugees in the United States, you know, and there was, and that was quickly followed by, you know, drinking water bans in Vancouver and the first green Christmas in recorded human history for 10 Canadian cities last year. And so it's not something that is an academic exercise, you know, that's maybe happening. We are not only affecting places that people might love or have some experience with being in the wilderness like British Columbians, we're affecting the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the climate that regulates the planet, and people can't ignore it anymore. And I think as we begin to see more and more occurrences and natural disasters, which are going to happen, you know, 2 weeks ago, the United Nations put out a new report that said that for the first time ever, they're announcing that a 2-degree warming is now unavoidable. And a 2-degree warming will mean catastrophic climate change with a dramatic increase in floods, fires, hurricanes, and other chaotic weather disturbances that will affect human society. So it isn't about now whether you have a soft and warm fuzzy spot for owls and bears or big trees. This is now a massive social issue that will lead to and is leading to social disruption and the disruption of our food systems and of political systems and will lead to civil war in many cases as resources become more scarce. People can't ignore it, so now it's everywhere. And that's manifesting in lots of weird ways. It's with, you know, millions of people going to see a PowerPoint on climate change and Paris Hilton wearing T-shirts about trees.
Why do you think British Columbians were so ahead of this curve?
Because we can appreciate the beauty just by looking outside. Because we can be more connected to nature easily. You know, you can be in downtown Vancouver and look up at the mountains. You could be 20 minutes and you're up on Cypress walking through the forest. It's, you know, or 10 minutes and you're down on the beach. Vancouver was very well planned in a lot of ways. You know, you look at other cities like Berkeley, where if you want to go down to the beach, you know, you're standing under a freeway, right? I think it's in large part, you know, part of it is the slower culture and the, you know, who knows, all the different cultural differences. But I think it has a lot to do with accessibility to nature and experience in nature and, you know, which is nice because that means the awareness results out of love and not fear, because I think, and I hate to be, you know, the voice of doom, but I think we're going to see a lot of fear and despair in the coming years as climate chaos hits us hard, and that's going to be a lot harder to deal with.
how do you keep hopeful? How do you think people should keep hopeful or can?
Well, I mean, for me, the fact that Vanity Fair is doing a green issue and, you know, and Paris Hilton's wearing tree t-shirts is hopeful. You know, our job as environmentalists used to be to kick open the door to the issue, to get people to notice. Well, we don't have to do that anymore. People know. And so now we can focus on pushing solutions, on developing solutions, on working with decision makers to identify, you know, the appropriate legislation, et cetera. Like our job is different today, and in some respects it's easier, and I think that's hopeful. And I guess also it's, well, two things. Barbara Kingsolver once said that as a parent, hope is the only moral choice, and I really feel that way. You know, my children remind me of, you know, remind me to have fun and play. And they also remind me every day how, you know, I can't do anything else. I have to do this. And success, you know, keeps me going. You know, we just in British Columbia, Forest Ethics just helped to ensure that over 90% of the mountain caribou's habitat, core winter habitat, is protected in the inland temperate rainforest. And that means about 400,000 hectares of old growth forests was protected last month. And you know, that's big. That's you know, 400,000 hectares is bigger than all of Clackwood Sound. And that feels good to know that that's protected forever. And that, you know, the fact that I think that we can do that, and we can do so much more, because if there was ever a moment to be working on these issues when you have the attention of decision makers, you know, this is our moment, and that's pretty hopeful.
Now, you've been saying this is the tipping point for us.
Mm-hmm.
So anything you'd advise ordinary people to go out and do?
Organize. Don't sit out there and wait for someone else to organize something that you're going to be a part of. You know, we're seeing climate leadership in Europe because, you know, groups of 5 and 10 people in their communities are going to protest at City Hall for a carbon neutral city, or they're marching. You know, the folks in Vermont marched 10 days. 10 of them started, and by the time they got to Burlington, there were 1,000 of them, and now Burlington is going to be one of the first states to have a low-carbon fuel standard. And I think people need to organize. We need to hit the streets, and we need to sign up and support environmental groups that are working on these issues, like Forest Ethics and like so many other environmental organizations, because I think that we're responsible today not only for what we're doing and what we're buying and whether we're buying the right light bulbs. We're responsible not only for what we're doing, but for what we don't do. And I think that if we look back in 10 years and know that we didn't have the courage to stand with a placard in front of the legislature at a time when our very climate was threatened, then we'll regret it.
If somebody put you in charge of the forest today, what would you do? Somebody put you in charge of, I'm going to say for you, global environmental policy. Because I think you've got an awful lot of say in BC environmental policy now.
If someone put me in charge of the forest, I would protect all of the old growth that we have left. I would immediately ban the export of minimally processed products and raw logs, because I think we can support as many people, if not more, working in our forest today if we just get more jobs for every tree cut. I think we need greater value-added manufacturing in order to ensure that we still have healthy communities and we have healthy forests. So I would protect what's left. I would keep more of it at home. In order, honestly, to protect our forests, as great a threat as industrial logging is, probably a bigger threat now is global warming. And so I think for all issues, you know, if I could pass my magic wand, I would ensure a strong carbon tax and emissions reductions across the board at a provincial and at a national level, and set us on a pace for a carbon neutral Canada.
And how do you feel about trees?
How do I feel about trees? being in the forest is what makes me strong. I for me, trees are trees are life. Trees are, when I have those moments when I need to be strong, I picture those Sitka spruce trees in the Carmona Valley, and that's what and that's what I try and emulate.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for checking out the Green Chain Podcast. Coming up on future episodes, the President of the Forest Stewardship Council of Canada and Canada's best-known beachcomber, Jackson Davies. For the Tyee, I'm Mark Larignan.